A staircase, broad as a major highway, wound up through the tree, with vast rooms leading off at every landing. The sourceless yellow light was everywhere. There was also a sound like, Rincewind concentrated, trying to identify it, like far-off thunder, or a distant waterfall.
"It's the tree,"
said the Dryad shortly.
"What's it doing?" said Rincewind.
"Living."
"I wondered about that. I mean, are we really in a tree? Have I been reduced in size? From outside it looked narrow enough for me to put my arms round."
"It is."
But here I am inside it."
"You are."
Said Rincewind. Drueli laughed.
"I can see into your mind, false wizard. Am I not a dryad? Do you not know that what you belittle by the name tree is but the mere four-dimensional analogue of a whole multi-dimensional universe which... No, I can see you do not. I should have realized that you weren't a real wizard when I saw you didn't have a staff."
"Lost it in a fire," lied Rincewind automatically.
"No hat with magic sigils embroidered on it."
"It blew off."
"No familiar."
"It died. Look, thanks for rescuing me, but if you don't mind, I think I ought to be going. If you could show me the way out."
Something in her expression made him turn around. There were three he-dryads behind him. They were as naked as the woman, and unarmed. That last fact was irrelevant, however. They didn't look as though they would need weapons to fight Rincewind. They looked as though they could shoulder their way through solid rock and beat up a regiment of trolls into the bargain. The three handsome giants looked down at him with wooden menace. Their skins were the colour of walnut husks, and under it muscles bulged like sacks of melons. He turned around again and grinned weakly at Drueli. Life was beginning to take on a familiar shape again.
"I'm not rescued, am I?" he said. "I'm captured, right?"
"Of course."
"And you're not letting me go?"
It was a statement. Drueli shook her head.
"You hurt the tree. But you are lucky. Your friend is going to meet Belsham Haroth. You will only die."
From behind, two hands gripped his shoulders in much the same way that an old tree root coils relentlessly around a pebble.
"With a certain amount of ceremony, of course," the dryad went on, "after the sender of eight has finished with your friend."
All Rincewind could manage to say was, "You know, I never imagined there were he-dryads, not even in an oak tree."
One of the giants grinned at him. Drueli snorted.
"Stupid! Where do you think acorns come from?"
There was a vast, empty space like a hall, its roof lost in the golden haze. The endless stair ran right through it. Several hundred dryads were clustered at the other end of the hall. They parted respectfully when Drueli approached, and stared through Rincewind as he was propelled firmly along behind. Most of them were females, although there were a few of the giant males among them. They stood like god-shaped statues among the small, intelligent females. "Insects," thought Rincewind. "The tree is like a hive." But why were there dryads at all? As far as he could recall, the tree people had died out centuries before. They had been out-evolved by humans, like most of the other Twilight peoples. Only elves and trolls had survived the coming of man to the Discworld. The elves because they were altogether too clever by half, and the trollen folk because they were at least as good as humans at being nasty, spiteful and greedy. Dryads were supposed to have died out along with gnomes and pixies. The background roar was louder here. Sometimes a pulsing golden glow would race up the translucent walls until it was lost in the haze overhead. Some power in the air made it vibrate.
"Oh, incompetent wizard," said Drueli. "See some magic. Not your weasel-faced tame magic, but root and branch magic. The old magic. Wild magic. Watch."
50 or so of the females formed a tight cluster, joined hands, and walked backwards until they formed the circumference of a large circle. The rest of the dryads began a low chant. Then, at a nod from Drueli, the circle began to spin widdershins. As the pace began to quicken and the complicated threads of the chant began to rise, Rincewind found himself watching, fascinated. He had heard about the old magic at university, although it was forbidden to wizards. He knew that when the circle was spinning fast enough against the standing magical field of the Discworld itself in its slow turning, the resulting astral friction would build up a vast potential difference which would earth itself by a vast discharge of the elemental magical force. The circle was a blur now, and the walls of the tree rang with the echoes of the chant. Rincewind felt the familiar sticky prickling in the scalp that indicated the build-up of a heavy charge of raw enchantment in the vicinity, and so he was not utterly amazed when a few seconds later a shaft of vivid octarine light speared down from the invisible ceiling and focused crackling in the centre of the circle. There it formed an image of a storm-swept, tree-girt hill with a temple on its crest. Its shape did unpleasant things to the eye. Rincewind knew that if it was a temple to Bel Shamharoth, it would have 8 sides. 8 was also the number of Bel Shamharoth, which was why a sensible wizard would never mention the number if he could avoid it. "Or you'll be 8 alive," apprentices were jocularly warned. Bel Shamharoth was especially attracted to dabblers in magic, who, by being as it were beachcombers on the shores of the unnatural, were already half enmeshed in his nets. Rincewind's room number in his hall of residence had been 7A. He hadn't been surprised. Rain streamed off the black walls of the temple. The only sign of life was the horse tethered outside, and it wasn't Two Flowers' horse. For one thing, it was too big. It was a white charger with hooves the size of meat dishes and leather harness aglitter with ostentatious gold ornamentation. It was currently enjoying a nosebag. There was something familiar about it. Rincewind tried to remember where he'd seen it before. It looked as though it was capable of a fair turn of speed, anyway, a speed which, once it had lumbered up to it, it could maintain for a long time. All Rincewind had to do was shake off his guards, fight his way out of the tree, find the temple, and steal the horse out from under whatever it was that Bel Shamharoth used for a nose.
"The sender of 8 has 2 for dinner, it seems," said Drueli, looking hard at Rincewind. "Who does that steed belong to, false wizard?"
"I've no idea."
"No? Well, it does not matter. We shall see soon enough."
She waved a hand. The focus of the image moved inwards, darted through a great octagonal archway, and sped along the corridor within. There was a figure there, sidling along stealthily with its back against one wall. Rincewind saw the gleam of gold and bronze. There was no mistaking that shape. He'd seen it many times. The wide chest, the neck like a tree trunk, the surprisingly small head under its wild thatch of black hair looking like a tomato on a coffin. He could put a name to the creeping figure, and that name was Hrun the Barbarian. Hrun was one of the Circle Sea's more durable heroes. A fighter of dragons, a despoiler of temples, a hired sword, the king post of every street brawl. He could even, and unlike many heroes of Rincewind's acquaintance, speak words of more than 2 syllables, if given time, and maybe a hint or two. There was a sound on the edge of Rincewind's hearing. It sounded like several skulls bouncing down the steps of some distant dungeon. He looked sideways at his guards to see if they'd heard it. They had all their limited attention focused on Hrun, who was admittedly built on the same lines as themselves. Their hands were resting lightly on the wizard's shoulders. Rincewind ducked, jerked backwards like a tumbler, and came up running. Behind him, he heard Drueli shout, and he redoubled his speed. Something caught the hood of his robe, which tore off. A he-dryad waiting at the stairs spread his arms wide and grinned woodenly at the figure hurtling towards him. Without breaking his stride, Rincewind ducked again, so low that his chin was on level with his knees, while a fist like a log sizzled through the air by his ear. Ahead of him, a whole spinney of the tree men awaited. He spun around, dodged another blow from the puzzled guard, and sped back towards the circle, passing on the way the dryads who were pursuing him and leaving them as disorganized as a set of skittles. But there were still more in front, pushing their way through the crowds of females and smacking their fists into the horny palms of their hands with anticipatory concentration.
"Stand still, false wizard," said Drueli, stepping forward.
Behind her, the enchanted dancers spun on. The focus of the circle was now drifting along a violet-lit corridor. Rincewind cracked.
"Will you knock that off?" he snarled. "Let's just get this straight, eh? I am a real wizard."
He stamped a foot petulantly.
"Indeed," said the dryad. "Then let us see you pass a spell."
"Began Rincewind.
The fact was that since the ancient and mysterious spell had squatted in his mind, he had been unable to remember even the simplest cantrip for, say, killing cockroaches or scratching the small of his back without using his hands. The mages at Unseen University had tried to explain this by suggesting that the involuntary memorizing of the spell had, as it were, tied up all his spell retention cells. In his darker moments, Rincewind had come up with his own explanation as to why even minor spells refused to stay in his head for more than a few seconds. They were scared, he decided. He repeated.
A small one would do, said Drueli,
watching him curl his lips in a frenzy of anger and embarrassment. She signalled, and a couple of he-dryads closed in. The spell chose that moment to vault into the temporarily abandoned saddle of Rincewind's consciousness. He felt it sitting there, leering defiantly at him.
"I do know a spell," he said wearily.
"Yes? Pray tell," said Drueli.
Rincewind wasn't sure that he dared, although the spell was trying to take control of his tongue. He fought it.
"You said you could read my mind," he said indistinctly. "Read it."
She stepped forward, looking mockingly into his eyes. Her smile froze. Her hands raised protectively, she crouched back. From her throat came a sound of pure terror. Rincewind looked around. The rest of the dryads were also backing away. What had he done? Something terrible, apparently. But in his experience, it was only a matter of time before the normal balance of the universe restored itself and started doing the usual terrible things to him. He backed away, ducked between the still-spinning dryads who were creating the magic circle, and watched to see what Drueli would do next.
"Grab him!" she screamed. "Take him a long way from the tree and kill him!"
Rincewind turned and bolted, across the focus of the circle. There was a brilliant flash. There was a sudden darkness. There was a vaguely Rincewind-shaped violet shadow dwindling to a point and winking out. There was nothing at all. Hrun, the barbarian, crept soundlessly along the corridors, which were lit with a light so violet that it was almost black. His earlier confusion was gone. This was obviously a magical temple, and that explained everything. It explained why, earlier in the afternoon, he had espied a chest by the side of the track while riding through this benighted forest. Its top was invitingly open, displaying much gold. But when he had leapt off his horse to approach it, the chest had sprouted legs and gone trotting off into the forest, stopping again a few hundred yards away. Now, after several hours of teasing pursuit, he had lost it in these hell-lit tunnels. On the whole, the unpleasant carvings and occasional disjointed skeletons he passed held no fears for Hrun. This was partly because he was not exceptionally bright, while being at the same time exceptionally unimaginative, but it was also because odd carvings and perilous tunnels were all in a day's work. He spent a great deal of time in similar situations, seeking gold or demons or distressed virgins, and relieving them respectively of their owners, their lives, and at least one cause of their distress. Observe Hrun as he leaps cat-footed across a suspicious tunnel mouth. Even in this violet light his skin gleams coppery. There is much gold about his person, in the form of anklets and wristlets, but otherwise he is naked, except for a leopard-skin loincloth. He took that in the steaming forests of Hawondoland, after killing its owner with his teeth. In his right hand, he carried the magical black sword Kring, which was forged from a thunderbolt, and has a soul but suffers no scabbard. Hrun had stolen it only 3 days before from the impregnable palace of the Archmandrite of B'ituni, and he was already regretting it. It was beginning to get on his nerves.
"I tell you, it went down that last passage on the right," hissed Kring, in a voice like the scrape of a blade over stone.
"Be silent."
"All I said was..."
"Shut up."
And Two Flower, he was lost. He knew that. Either the building was much bigger than it looked, or he was now on some wide underground level without having gone down any steps, or, as he was beginning to suspect, the inner dimensions of the place disobeyed a fairly basic rule of architecture by being bigger than the outside. And why all these strange lights? They were eight-sided crystals set at regular intervals in the walls and ceiling, and they shed a rather unpleasant glow that didn't so much illuminate as outline the darkness. And whoever had done those carvings on the wall, Two Flower thought charitably, had probably been drinking too much, for years. On the other hand, it was certainly a fascinating building. Its builders had been obsessed with the number 8. The floor was a continuous mosaic of 8-sided tiles. The corridor walls and ceilings were angled to give the corridors 8 sides, if the walls and ceilings were counted, and in those places where part of the masonry had fallen in, Twoflower noticed that even the stones themselves had 8 sides.
"I don't like it,"
said the picture imp from his box around Twoflower's neck.
"Why not?" inquired Twoflower.
"It's weird."
"But you're a demon. Demons can't call things weird. I mean, what's weird to a demon?"
"Oh, you know,"
said the demon cautiously, glancing around nervously and shifting from claw to claw.
"Things. Stuff."
Twoflower looked at him sternly.
"What things?"
The demon coughed nervously. Demons do not breathe. However, every intelligent being, whether it breathes or not, coughs nervously at some time in its life, and this was one of them as far as the demon was concerned.
"Oh, things,"
it said wretchedly.
"Evil things. Things we don't talk about is the point I'm broadly trying to get across, Master."
Twoflower shook his head wearily.
"I wish Rincewind was here," he said. "He'd know what to do."
"Him?"
sneered the demon.
"Can't see a wizard coming here. They can't have anything to do with the number 8.
The demon slapped a hand across his mouth guiltily. Twoflower looked up at the ceiling.
"What was that?"
he asked.
"Didn't you hear something?"
"Me? Here? No, not a thing,"
the demon insisted. It jerked back into its box and slammed the door. Twoflower tapped on it. The door opened a crack.
"It sounded like a stone moving,"
he explained. The door banged shut. Twoflower shrugged.
"This place is probably falling to bits," he said to himself.
He stood up.
I say. Is anyone there? 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 Hello? 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 I know there's someone there. I just heard you playing dice. There.
I just heard you playing dice. There. I just heard you playing dice. I just heard you playing dice. I just heard you playing dice.
Look, I had just...
Twoflower stopped. The reason for this was the bright point of light that had popped into existence a few feet from his eyes. It grew rapidly, and after a few seconds was the tiny bright shape of a man. At this stage, it began to make a noise, or rather, Twoflower started to hear the noise it had been making all along. It sounded like a sliver of a scream caught in one long instant of time. The iridescent man was doll-sized now, a tortured shape tumbling in slow motion while hanging in mid-air. Twoflower wondered why he had thought of the phrase "a sliver of a scream," and began to wish he hadn't. It was beginning to look like Rincewind. The wizard's mouth was open, and his face was brilliantly lit by the light of, what, strange suns, Twoflower found himself thinking. Suns men don't usually see. He shivered. Now the turning wizard was half man-size. At that point the growth was faster. There was a sudden crowded moment, a rush of air, and an explosion of sound. Rincewind tumbled out of the air, screaming. He hit the floor hard, choked, then rolled over with his head cradled in his arms and his body curled up tightly. When the dust had settled, Twoflower reached out gingerly and tapped the wizard on the shoulder. The human ball rolled up tighter.
"It's me,"
explained Twoflower helpfully. The wizard unrolled a fraction.
"What?"
he said.
"Me!"
In one movement, Rincewind unrolled and bounced up in front of the little man, his hands gripping his shoulders desperately. His eyes were wild and wide.
"Don't say it," he hissed. "Don't say it and we might get out."
"Get out? How did you get in? Don't you know..."
"Don't say it."
Twoflower backed away from this madman.
"Don't say it."
"Don't say what?"
"The number."
"Number?"
said Twoflower.
"Hey, Rincewind,
yes, number between 7 and 9, 4 plus 4.
"What, 8?
Rincewind's hands clapped over the man's mouth.
"Say it and we're doomed. Just don't think about it, right? Trust me."
"I don't understand," wailed Twoflower.
Rincewind relaxed slightly, which was to say that he still made a violin string look like a bowl of jelly.
"Come on," he said, "let's try and get out, and I'll try and tell you."
After the first age of magic, the disposal of grimoires began to become a severe problem on the Discworld. A spell is still a spell, even when imprisoned temporarily in parchment and ink. It has potency. This is not a problem while the book's owner still lives, but on his death, the spellbook becomes a source of uncontrolled power that cannot easily be diffused. In short, spellbooks leak magic. Various solutions have been tried. Countries near the rim simply loaded down the books of dead mages with leaden pentalfas and threw them over the edge. Near the hub, less satisfactory alternatives were available. Inserting the offending books in canisters of negatively polarized octyron and sinking them in the fathomless depths of the sea was one. Burial in deep caves on land was earlier ruled out after some districts complained of walking trees and five-headed cats. But before long, the magic seeped out, and eventually fishermen complained of shoals of invisible fish or psychic clams. A temporary solution was the construction, in various centres of magical lore, of large rooms made of denatured octyron, which is impervious to most forms of magic. Here, the more critical grimoires could be stored until their potency had attenuated. That was how there came to be at Unseen University the Octavo, greatest of all grimoires, formerly owned by the creator of the universe. It was this book that Rincewind had once opened for a bet. He had only had a second to stare at a page before setting off various alarm spells, but this was time enough for one spell to leap from it and settle in his memory like a toad in a stone.
"Then what?" said Twoflower.
"Oh, they dragged me out, thrashed me, of course."
"And no one knows what the spell does?"
Rincewind shook his head.
"It had vanished from the page," he said. "No one will know until I say it. Or until I die, of course. Then it will sort of say itself. For all I know, it stops the universe, or ends time, or anything."
Twoflower patted him on the shoulder.
"No sense in brooding," he said cheerfully. "Let's have another look for a way out."
Rincewind shook his head. All the terror had been spent now. He had broken through the terror barrier, perhaps, and was in the dead calm state of mind that lies on the other side. Anyway, he had ceased to gibber.
"We're doomed," he stated. "We've been walking around all night. I tell you, this place is a spider-web. It doesn't matter which way we go, we'll end up in the centre."
"It was kind of you to come looking for me anyway," said Twoflower. "How did you manage it exactly? It was very impressive."
"Oh, well," began the wizard awkwardly, "I just thought I can't leave old Twoflower there and..."
"So what we've got to do now is find this Belshamharoth person and explain things to him, and perhaps he'll let us out," said Twoflower.
Rincewind ran a finger around his ear.
"It must be the funny echoes in here," he said. "I thought I heard you use words like find and explain."
"That's right."
Rincewind glared at him in the hellish purple glow.
"Find Belshamharoth," he said.
"Yes. We don't have to get involved."
"Find the soul render and not get involved? Just give him a nod, I suppose, and ask the way to the exit. Explain things to the sender of the aim..."
Rincewind bit off the end of the word just in time and finished,
"You're insane. Hey, come back."
He darted down the passage after Twoflower and after a few moments came to a halt with a groan. The violet light was intense here, giving everything new and unpleasant colours. This wasn't a passage. It was a wide room with walls to a number that Rincewind didn't dare to contemplate, and A and 7A passages radiating from it. Rincewind saw, a little way off, a low altar with the same number of sides as 4 times 2. It didn't occupy the centre of the room, however. The centre was occupied by a huge stone slab with twice as many sides as a square. It looked massive. In the strange light it appeared to be slightly tilted, with one edge standing proud of the slabs around it. Twoflower was standing on it.
"Hey, Rincewind, look what's here,"